Hello everyone, I'm Harry Bucknell. Thank you for downloading this podcast from ABF, the Soldiers' Charity. ABF, the Soldiers' Charity, supports some 60,000 soldiers, veterans and their immediate families in 63 countries around the world throughout the year. We are entirely reliant on you, our ever-generous supporters, to raise funds. And as last year, on 25th of February, we held an online host of military entertainment for our second Friday Night In. In this edition of General Talk, TV news presenter Simon McCoy is in conversation with former international gymnast, sports presenter and TV host Gabby Logan in an at times highly personal and revealing interview about her work in broadcasting, the challenges she faces, how the workplace has changed for her and women in general with the rise of women's sport since she first started work at Sky in 1996. I hope you enjoy the programme.
Gabby Logan, so good to see you. And I know how busy you are. Here we are. Six Nations is already underway and many of us will have seen you already on the screen. And the thing is, and I know this as well as you do, to look that calm and cool belies total chaos on a live broadcast, doesn't it?
Yeah, there's quite often stuff happening in my ears that my job, as I see it, is to not let the viewer know about. And the reason I want to know what's going on in my ears is because I want to know if there's a problem coming down the line. So, yeah, there's noise. In stadiums like Murrayfield with the Calcutta Cup, you know, the noise levels are just off the scale. And so no matter how brilliant and professional your earpieces are, you know, of course, you can't help but kind of hear that noise. There's pipers. Your guests are having problems with their sound. So, yeah, there's a lot going on. And then in the midst of it all, obviously, you're trying to kind of disseminate and analyse, you know, something important that's happened on the pitch. But it's all good fun and I absolutely love it, Simon. So, you know, I'd never complain.
Is it always good fun? I mean, where has it ever gone so wrong where you thought I'd rather be anywhere else?
Yeah, there have been times where it's gone wrong, but actually those times I kind of like, you know, when things are starting to go a little bit wrong, because it's the adrenaline that you get from that experience. And obviously the first time those things happen when you're starting out your career, it's awful. But the more you do and the more hours of live telly that you do, those things are kind of what you get your kicks from, I think. The days where actually I don't love it as much as where things are a bit dull and it, you know, it's just all a little bit pedestrian and you're doing something that's maybe a little bit lower key, a live match that's not got a massive crowd, or you're kind of, you know, nothing sensational happens. The match isn't that interesting and the guests are a little bit, you know, kind of below par that day. Those are the days where you think, oh, there's no adrenaline today. This feels like a, you know, just like I'm doing any old kind of, you know, job happening today. So it doesn't feel the same.
I wouldn't ever associate the word mundane with anything I've ever seen you do, to be honest. But you've done the Commonwealth Games, rugby we've spoken about, Sports Personality of the Year, so many different types of events. Is there a particular favourite for you?
I love doing Sports Personality of the Year, you mentioned there, because lots of reasons, actually. It's a huge live event. And until COVID, we did it in massive arenas with 10,000 people. So it's the closest I'm ever going to feel to being a pop star, going on stage at places, you know, where you normally get Ed Sheeran performing. And actually, we do have amazing musical performers at those events, like, you know, Lewis Capaldi and, you know, Sam Fender, those kinds of people. And then the sports stars who come, you know, in the past, we've had such iconic global stars from, you know, the likes of Michael Phelps to Dan Carter, you know, you get people flown in from all around the world who come in to collect the global awards. And then the domestic kind of stars who turn up as well. And everybody's glamorous on the night. And it's a massive show, loads going on, lots of moving parts, tons of cameras. So that's a particular favourite. But I love working on major championships, World Cups and Six Nations, you've mentioned, is one of my favourites, actually. And Olympic Games are always, you know, a joy, because the Olympics is, for me, it's just that in spite of, you know, kind of some people are cynical about the Olympics and the commercialization of the Olympics, and there'll always be a drug story. But at its heart, 99% of the people who are performing there are doing it because they love sport. You know, most of them won't earn a living from sport. We're very lucky in this country. Our athletes and sports people have the national lottery. But in other countries, you know, it's a route to finding something better in life or to achieving something just for their country. So it's that kind of real honest spirit of sport that I love about the Olympics and the Paralympics.
Well, you know what you're talking about because you represented Wales in the gymnastics, of course, at the Commonwealth Games. I mean, was that a good grounding for broadcasting? I mean, are there crossovers between sport and what you're doing now?
Yeah, I obviously the sport I did and to the highest level I did any sport was gymnastics, and I don't really present gymnastics these days. I've done world championships and things in the past. But I think what being a sports person in the past has given me is an appreciation of what sports people go through to get to the top and how, you know, how many challenges and kind of, you know, travails they kind of have to cross to reach the pinnacle of their sports. But also growing up with a dad who was a football manager and footballer, and married to, when I first married my husband, he was still playing rugby. You know, I've seen firsthand kind of the disappointments, the, you know, the agonies, the injuries, the, you know, the ecstasies, how you manage kind of all those things. And so I think it gives me, probably I've had an appreciation of those human kind of stories, if you like. And that's what always draws me into sport anyway, is the human side of sport and the, you know, the stories behind the stars, if you like, because I kind of find metronomic sports stars, you know, the ones that just seem to churn out results, don't seem as interesting to me. I like it when somebody's had something a little bit different on their journey. And I think also having experienced kind of the other side of sport, if you like, I appreciate sometimes that they just don't want to talk to you occasionally, you know, when things have gone wrong, they might not be at their most verbose and they might not be interested in giving you long-winded answers. And you should never actually kind of think that the sports person that you're talking to is your friend, you know, even if they're being very lovely and genial, actually they're doing a job and some days they just don't want to chat. So it's given me an appreciation of that.
Yeah, but you're doing your job, aren't you? You're treading that fine line where the audience expects you to get an answer, even if the person you're talking to doesn't want to give one. That's where you come in.
Yeah, and that's, you know, you do your very best to try and pull something out. And it's easier with the pundits who are working in the studio because that's their job. They're being paid to talk about the sport. It's harder when you're talking to somebody who's just come off the pitch. I found that role, I did it quite a few World Cups and a few European Championships with the England football team. And I found it a really challenging role because largely in my experience from the 2010 World Cup onwards, things didn't go so well. In 2018, which was the last championship I did, England made the semi-finals of that World Cup. And actually it was my best experience. And I don't think it's any coincidence that that was my favorite World Cup to work on because everything was going so well. So everybody wanted to sit down and chat to you. You know, the manager couldn't kind of wait to sit down and talk because there was so much positivity around that squad. And maybe that was actually, maybe the positivity actually lent itself to more, to performances on the pitch becoming more successful. You know, which came first, the chicken or the egg in that camp? I can't tell you, but that was my personal kind of highlight in terms of a football World Cup, was working on the Russia World Cup. Largely as well, because I got to go to places in Russia that I don't think I'd ever even heard of, you know, before, let alone been to. I've been to Moscow and St. Petersburg before, but I got to go to cities that I never would have gone to and meet Russians that I never would have met and find out a lot more about that country, scratch beneath the surface. And that's another absolute joy, I think, of the job that I do.
That job you do has changed dramatically in the time that you've been doing it, and particularly for women, hasn't it? I mean, you have seen a remarkable change on the pitches, on the courts. Women's sport is now out there. And for women broadcasters, my word, what a change.
Yeah, when I first started out at Sky, I was very young. I'd just done a year in local radio after university and I was 23 years old. It was just after the 96 Euros, which were held in this country. And I don't think there was maybe one other woman who was working in front of the camera on Sky Sports at the time. And there weren't many women who were working behind the camera. There weren't many women producers. And over time, obviously, that's changed dramatically. The landscape's changed dramatically. And the environment has changed as well because of that. And it's, you know, for me, it's all the better for it, because I think the more diverse the input into it, programme making, then the more reflective it's going to be of society. So there are so many more opportunities in television and broadcasting, but also we've now got so much more women's sport on telly. And that change happened, I think, after the 2012 Olympics, because there were so many brilliant female stars who emerged from that Olympic Games, gold medalists, the likes of Helen Glover and Jessica Ennis-Hill and Beth Tweddle, and, you know, all these women who became well known and still are well known as great sports people, as well as huge success across a range of sports, that suddenly people started to kind of see women's sport in a different way, I think, and realised that we needed to show more of it more of the time. And so women's football now has more coverage than ever before. And obviously women's rugby now has more coverage, women's cricket has more coverage. And I think the more normal it becomes to see women doing sport, the debate just won't exist about whether or not, you know, it's a thing. And, you know, if you just if it's just good competitive sport, it doesn't matter who's playing it. I remember for me, a big turning point kind of in the way I think I felt society might be seeing things was through the eyes of one of my kids. I was watching the 2016 Olympics. I went out to do the athletics. So I was home for a few days when it had started, and the women's sevens tournament was happening, the rugby. And my son was sat down. He loves his rugby, and he was sat down. He would have been about 11 at the time, and he was sat watching the women's semi-final. And I said, "Oh, I'm so pleased that you're watching the women's sevens." And he went, "This is just good rugby." And he couldn't see why I was so kind of thrilled, you know, as a supporter of women's sport. And I thought, yeah, he's right. This is just good rugby. And I think the more we kind of see sport for that, this is, you know, men's football can be dire, you know. So we don't have to kind of, like, every time there's a bad women's football match, you don't have to point it out. It just happens sometimes that there's a match that's not of great quality, and it happens in all sports for all genders.
Yeah, you mentioned 2012 London, the legacy of those games. You've touched on one legacy. Of course, the military was involved in that. There were 18,000 military people making London happen. I just want to know what your memories of what must have been an amazing event. Was there anything that Hank particularly
Rebrines? Well, I'm glad you mentioned that, Simon, because it's one of my career highlights, absolutely, for sure. I just loved, I think the year up to London, I felt like I spent the whole time defending the Olympics. So many anecdotes I could tell you where I got into disagreements with people who were telling me it was going to be a nightmare, it was going to be expensive, it was going to be a waste of time. And I think what it did was prove to us as a nation, you know, that we put ourselves down a lot, but when we come together and we do something like that, we do it really well. And we gave the world a fantastic show, and it was a brilliant Games. But the military was a really interesting thing, because that was where things were starting to go a little bit awry at the top, because the security issues were kind of not being, let's say they weren't very smooth around the Olympic Village and the Olympic Stadium. And so the military were brought in to help things process things a bit quicker. And that was something that I was dealing with on a daily basis, because I was coming through security every day. And of course, it made a massive difference when the army came and started doing that. But they did it with a smile, and they did it with, you know, a brilliant humour. And I remember thinking, oh, thank God they're here. I just felt so, you know, and actually it felt kind of right, because, you know, these are people who represent our country all the time. So it felt right that they were alongside other people who were representing our country. And that's the face we were showing to the world. And, you know, I travel all over the world, and the military are often brought in to help big events like that, because they organise things very, very well. So that part of it, I was, you know, I'm thrilled I've been able to say thank you, because they were so, so amazing. But as an overall event, and I've been to so many games and so many different World Cups and things, and, you know, it really, London was just spectacular from start to finish. And I was so proud at the end of it that we'd kind of pulled it off, because I remember when we were given the games, we were granted the games back in 2005. And at the time I wasn't working for the BBC. And eventually when I did move over, it was my absolute kind of, you know, career goal that I'd work on Olympic Games, to get to work on one in my, you know, home country, in the town, the city that I was living in. Well, I didn't think anything could get better than that, you know, and it's 10 years since then. I can't believe we're coming up the 10th anniversary, and I still kind of eulogise about it, the experience. And I think we're still seeing the legacy in terms of young sports people today in all kinds of sports who are inspired by that Games. I speak to female footballers who, you know, saw that Olympic Games and thought, gosh, what could I do? What could I be? And so it doesn't necessarily mean that you became Jessica Ennis Hill, but I think it inspired young people to achieve in a range of sports and activities.
Another crossover, if you like, military and sports people, is that discipline. And we've seen that too with the Paralympics, haven't we? And people like JJ Chalmers, who springs to mind, who actually followed in your footsteps in doing Strictly Come Dancing, didn't he? We've changed so many attitudes because of sport.
Yeah, the Paralympics in London was the first time that sessions in the morning were sold out, as well as sessions in the afternoons. You know, the Paralympics in previous guises in other countries had struggled to sell the tickets. It was kind of like an after the Lord Mayor's show thing. It came after the Olympics and there was support, but nothing like London. London was a sellout. And you speak to those Paralympians who, you know, were in that Olympic stadium, and especially in the athletics stadium, and I was with Hannah Cockcroft, that was the Games that kind of brought her to our attention. And I was with her just before Christmas, and, you know, she said, you know, that was such a milestone for them. And it was like, this is what we expect going forwards with other Paralympic Games. This is the kind of, you know, environment we should have and the celebration we should have. And there's been a great crossover of ex-military going into, I mean, especially through Invictus as well, which is where JJ kind of came to prominence. And, you know, and moving into using their sporting prowess, you know, after they've been injured and involved in accidents, in a really positive way. And And the Paralympics is, again, you know, to use another family anecdote, I remember going, walking my kids to school just after the Paralympics, and they were seven, and my son said, right, I'm going to be Johnny Peacock and you can be Usain Bolt, to his twin sister. He didn't see any difference between the two of them. They were just two great athletes. And again, I think that societal attitudes towards disability was shifted, because people didn't see somebody, you know, in a wheelchair, kind of, you know, just, oh, you're just in a wheel. That's somebody who's got potentially enormous, you know, kind of athletic prowess and can do other things. It's not just about kind of marginalizing people and kind of giving them a 10% experience of life. So many champions, I think, have been kind of born from those games and have changed the way we look at disability in society.
And that's something sports people can do. You look at Marcus Rashford, we suddenly have role models, don't we? You talk about your children. That is something that sports people perhaps uniquely can give us.
Yeah, and I feel sometimes that, you know, some sports people don't want to be role models. That's not to say they want to be anti-role models, but they don't, you know, they find that tag uncomfortable, and they don't, you know, they want to be good at sport, but they don't necessarily want to be a spokesperson for issues in society. But those that do have a really powerful platform, as you've mentioned, Marcus Rashford, who did phenomenal things right from the very start of the pandemic, the lockdown. That's when he started getting onto the school meals kind of bandwagon and wanted to kind of make sure kids were being fed. From his own personal experiences, he used that to try and drive change, which he's done enormous change. And then, you know, you've got people who have talked about their mental health. And when sports people who are seen as these kind of, you know, colossuses, they're seen as these people who are just totally brilliant at, you know, what they do, and how could they possibly have anything wrong with them? If, you know, unless it's a broken leg, we can't see, you know, that their mental side of their game and what's going on. So when they talk about their mental health and their struggles that they've had, I think it becomes so much more accessible for people who revere them and look up to them to think, well, actually, I've struggled a little bit with anxiety, or I've had depression, or I've had, you know, what you're talking about, it relates to me. So I think it's when sports people do want to use their platform, it cuts through so well. And, you know, but as I say, I don't think every sports person feels comfortable doing that. And we shouldn't expect them all to want to do that. But I do think we can expect a decent standard of behaviour and, you know, conduct that is befitting the kinds of clubs they represent or the country they represent. And if they don't live up to that, then I think we should hold them to account on that.
Yeah. You talk about the toughness of sports people. I mean, you're pretty tough. You have to be pretty tough to get where you've got in your business. And on a personal level, you've seen tragedy. You were at the Bradford City Stadium when the fire happened. You left, I think, the stand just before it broke out. You lost a brother at the age of 15. And I just wonder if events like that, moments like that, are a reserve you still draw on as a broadcaster.
Yeah, I think they probably are. Those two in particular are things that shape you as a person and are things that kind of never go away in terms of the impact they have on family life and the extended family, and, you know, how that kind of, how things may have been different, you know, when you have that sliding doors and you look and think how our lives as a family might have been different if my brother hadn't died. And also with Bradford, I think that was a real, it was a game changer in many ways in how we watch football, together with obviously Hillsborough. It led to huge changes in terms of the, you know, the way football stadiums are set up and security and policing, which then ultimately led to the start of the Premier League, because, you know, once football had to kind of get rid of a lot of issues and problems, and that led to football becoming more attractive to watch. And those things were tragedies that shouldn't have had to happen to drive change. And of course, everybody who died in the Bradford fire had, you know, families who still grieve. And, you know, our family was affected in as much as, although none of us were injured and we were sat really close to where the fire started. You know, my dad went to 40 odd funerals in the space of a month, and he came home every day wearing a black tie, and he was assistant manager and with red eyes, and, you know, he just cried constantly for many, many weeks. And at that time, nobody really turned around to him and said, let's have some counselling. And I think it's affected him to this day, you know, the things that he saw, heard and witnessed afterwards. So so those things have definitely affected the kind of DNA of our family in lots of ways. And personally, I think when you go through those kinds of things, when you come through the other side, I think you realise what you can go through as a human being. And it teaches you a lot, but it also you have to examine things like, you know, your own personal perspective has to kind of still have empathy, and you still have to, you know, because when you go through something like that quite young, you start to think, well, I know what's important in life, and that's not important, and that's not important. But of course, to other people who've not experienced those tragedies, you know, their levels of perspective are different. So I went through quite a lot of that in my early 20s, where I had to really sit down and have a counselor and kind of find myself a therapist, because I kind of was a little bit confused about, you know, what life was all about with those things. But once I'd come through that, I did then feel like, okay, this is my superpower now. Do you know what I mean? I've learned so much through this that I'm going to take this as a positive into my life. And if I can help make change with regards to, or help to campaign, whether it was to do with things to do with heart testing, to do with my brother, any of those things, then I would happily lend my voice, if I had one, to those causes.
Yeah, you've worked for pretty much every broadcaster I can name, and that's something that's changed in our lifetimes, the number of broadcasters around. I'm just wondering where you are headed, because you in your time, you've interviewed so many people, you've got your podcast that you do. Is there anybody who's really stood out who you thought, my word, that is an interview I will never forget?
Oh, gosh, I've interviewed so many of the current greats in sport, and I've interviewed people outside of sport. You know, I worked on Five Live for quite a few years as well, and I've been, you know, and always I find people fascinating, you know. So sometimes you'd sit down to do an interview, and I worked on Radio Five Live, and it wouldn't be with somebody that was a household name. They'd just gone through something incredible. I remember in the early part of the last decade, in doing a lot of interviews, sadly, about something that is still a curse and a blight on our society now, to do with knife crime and young gangs, particularly in London, and speaking to the mother of a boy, a young boy who was killed, and her, you know, her grief, but also her composure and her passion for trying to make change. I remember coming away feeling like, you know, life really isn't fair, you know, and that, and he was an innocent bystander in that situation, and feeling as impacted by her as, say, the day that I spent interviewing Usain Bolt. Do you know what I mean? So, I think people have great stories to tell, and that's what I just love about my job, that I get to try and get those stories out. But in terms of enjoyability, one of the days that I'll always say is one of my favourite days at work was a show I used to do called Inside Sport on the BBC. And I used to go and spend a full day with the sports person. So I had a day in Monaco with Novak Djokovic. You know, we went to the Monaco Yacht Club for lunch, and then we walked around the streets. And so trying to immerse yourself into that person's life. And in that series, I interviewed Andy Murray, and I went to Roehampton, where he was training at the National Tennis Centre at the time, and watched him train. And then I interviewed him. We had lunch. And then he said, oh, do you want to come and do a gym session with me? And anybody who knows me will tell you, I love working out and I love exercising. And I got to do like a core session with Andy Murray, who was congratulating me on my core. And that was one of those days. I went going home saying to my husband, that was the best day at work, because I just love Andy Murray anyway. So the fact he gave me a compliment at the end of the day. And then going back to one of your earlier questions, it's quite interesting, because then after the 2012 Olympics, he got the silver medal, if you remember, in the mixed doubles with Lord Robson. And he was disappointed, because he's a winner, right? He didn't want a silver, he wanted a gold. And in the interview we did live through the studio, he was a bit kind of like miserable about getting a silver. And it made me kind of, he's not your mate. You know, you spent the day with him, but, you know, he's not going to just turn on the charm because he's got a silver. And that was one of those moments of realization where you go, all right, okay, yeah, he's absolutely a competitor. And it doesn't matter how friendly and affable he was one day, if he loses the next, he's not going to just turn it on. And actually, I'm always suspicious of the sports people who are too jolly in defeat, you know, kind of want them to hurt and be a little bit bruised.
Between us, just between us, who was the most horrible person you've ever interviewed?
Yeah, because this will go nowhere, right? The internet doesn't exist, and nobody's ever going
to... just between you and me.
Oh, Al, see, nobody's really horrible, but you do have moments where, you know, you're struggling to kind of get that person to open up a little bit, and you feel like they don't really want to be there, and they probably tell you afterwards that they didn't want to be there. And so, of course, I'm not going to say any names because I still want to work, Simon, in TV. But I remember once Kevin Keegan, who I got on brilliantly with, snapped at me once in a post-match interview when I was really, really early on in my career. And I was really upset because I was, but of course he was upset about losing. It was at Leeds United. He was upset about losing the game. And I got a bit, I was quite young and I took it quite personally. And then afterwards I realised that, you know, he was just upset about it. The next time he was absolutely fine. The absolute charmer, and who was never, ever, ever miserable, whatever the result, was Sir Bobby Robson. He was the nicest person you could ever want to work with. And he was always so lovely and so welcoming and so warm. And I still miss kind of going up to Newcastle and interviewing him, as I used to do many times.
Yeah, this is why you're so good, isn't it? I ask you who's the most horrible, you end up telling me who's the most charming. I see through it, but and it's a brilliant tactic. You're a loss to politics. But actually, I'll come to that in a moment. But I just want to know, is there one person that you still haven't interviewed who you would really like to just spend some time with?
I've never interviewed Lionel Messi or Cristiano Ronaldo. Never, which is, you know, kind of been at World Cups and stuff, but not done matches with them. And I'm not sure how interesting they would be and what they haven't said, but I would like to have had one, at least opportunity to interview one of them, I think. In terms of, like, you know, athletics, I've interviewed all the kind of the people, contemporaries that, you know, and I've even had Carl Lewis on a show, and, you know, I've interviewed so many great people in athletics. If looking across other sports, I've interviewed some pretty great rugby players as well. I'm trying to think of anybody in the world of rugby that I haven't interviewed. I mean, all the 2003 England World Cup winning team, pretty much I've known personally or I've interviewed, and so I feel really kind of privileged in that respect. I love interviewing Gareth Southgate, and when I was doing that job before, as I mentioned, in 2018, he was brilliant. I'm struggling to think of any. Oh, I tell you who, Roger Federer. Roger Federer. Yeah, I'd love to, because I've only ever kind of brushed past him kind of at Wimbledon, things like that, and in the BBC compound, and he's always just so lovely and charming. I'd love to do the kind of show I did before, where you go and spend a real day and immerse yourself in that person's life. I think that would be an interesting thing to do. And maybe on that basis, if we're doing tennis, I'd also like to do the same as Serena Williams. So there you go.
Right. Well, there's a to-do list for you. But what is next for you? I mean, you're not even halfway through your career. So I've mentioned politics. I think it'd be really good, actually. But what does the future hold for Gabby Logan?
I'm getting to the age where I'm 50 next year, and I can't believe I'm even saying that, because I really don't feel like I've done enough. You know, when you feel like, when I was younger and I saw 50, I thought that was a point where, you know, I first of all didn't think I'd still be on telly, and secondly, I thought I'd be in my second career or third career by now. And I've actually written a book which is out this year, and that's something I've always wanted to do, and I've got more books in me, I think. But I love doing what I do, and I want to do it for as long as I can. This year is another massive year in terms of major tournaments. We've got the Euros, the Women's Euros happening in England. That leads into the Commonwealth Games in Birmingham. And then I've got the World Athletics Championships, the European Athletics Championships. So it's another huge summer of sport. And then suddenly, before you know where you are, it's another spotty. And you're thinking, I can't believe I've done my 10th spotty, you know. So I think I'd like to...
That's Sports Personality of the Year.
Yes, we sorry. Call it. Yeah, sorry.
I may not realise that.
No, sorry. Sports Personality of the Year, yeah. So the years, because of supporting calendar, the years go so quickly. And as I say, I keep thinking, I should have done this by now. I should have done that by now. As I said to you before, I love interviewing people. So any opportunity I ever can get to do shows where I, you know, have that chance, I would. I used to want to be a long form interview. You know, when I first started out, I wanted to be Parkinson. And we don't really have those kinds of shows anymore, which is why podcasting is actually a really lovely release, because you get to have a long chat with somebody and dig a little bit deeper under the surface. But as long as they keep employing me to do something, Simon, I'm happy. I love doing what I do and being involved in lots of interesting, you know, causes and campaigns when I can. And, you know, seeing my kids kind of growing up and being interested in their world. It's good having teenagers, because you get to see a little, you know, the world through their eyes, which thankfully isn't as scary as I think I would feel if I was a teenager, because, you know, at times I think, gosh, this world's such a crazy world we live in. But the teenagers are giving me hope. They seem to kind of have things sorted out, and they're quite, you know, they've got their heads screwed on. So all the teenagers that I'm meeting through my kids, so I'm hopeful for the next gen.
Yeah, I mean, for soldiers, for veterans and their families who are watching you right now, is there a message about, well, I suppose hope is the one thing that we all sort of latch onto, isn't it?
Yeah, I think, you know, you mentioned before the landscape changing in television, and 24-hour news and the, you know, the need for content, and not just news as in the pure news that you've come from, that news broadcast journalism background, but news being content, you know, whether it's on TikTok or Instagram or wherever it is, this desire for constant content. I think sometimes we have, you know, we've created this beast that we need to keep putting money in the meter, and actually we don't take stock enough, and we don't realize actually that, you know, there's loads of great positive things going on, and the bad stuff seems to kind of, you know, get the headlines and get the banners. But I think there's a lot of positive things going on in the world, and I hope that actually we can kind of swing away a bit from this kind of crazy politics that we've seen of the last 5 to 7 years, where it seems to be about kind of personalities and egos, and actually causes and compassion and people's, you know, kind of collective embracing things collectively. It becomes a bit more important and to the forefront, because I think it's, you know, that's what the armed forces is about, right? It's working together as a team, and it's doing something, you know, noble that has a real aims and has proper substance to it. And I think so much of modern life just feels to be a little bit kind of out of kilter with that. So I'm hopeful that that we can kind of come back together. You know, I talked about 2012. That felt like a time we were really unified as a nation, and we had this real pride in ourselves. And it feels like we've lost a little bit of that pride. So I hope that somehow we can kind of come back and find that again. It can't be that far away, can it?
Amen to that. Gabby, it's such a great pleasure to talk to you. Gabby Logan, thank you very, very much.
Thank you very much, Simon.
And my thanks to Simon McCoy and Gabby Logan. And on behalf of Major General Tim Hyams, Chief Executive, and all the staff at ABF, the Soldiers Charity, and a huge thank you to everyone who so generously supported our Friday Night In. If you missed the opportunity to contribute to our fundraising, so vital for our work, and would like to help, please visit soldierscharity.org and click on the red donate button in the top right-hand corner. While visiting the website, you might like to browse its many events, such as the Lord Mayor's Platinum Jubilee Big Curry, which returns to Guildhall on Thursday the 7th of April, and I don't need to tell you, is the City of London's hottest event, raising funds to meet the current urgent need to support veterans of HM Armed Forces back into employment. Until next month, from me, Harry Butnell, farewell and thank you for listening. With editing by Michael Stiglianu, this podcast has been a Gamekeeper production for ABF, the Soldiers Charity.